come up with your own question. I'm not going to do it for you. I think I do have a refined sense of disgust. Disgust can be a very useful impulse. People think about habits as like, oh, your morning routine. And it's a much more profound concept. It's not just like, I'm going to drink a smoothie in the morning. It's like your thought patterns themselves are habitual. It's like very painful to fail. But like a lot of the potential reward is in doing things that are highly uncertain. Whatever the current thing is right now, like you are way more likely to be a pawn in whatever this game that's going on is than actually a live player in it. I suspect there's always a better way to do things. It's just kind of like an infinite improvement frontier in everything.
This is Audience of One, and I'm your host, Spencer Keir. My guest today is Michael Mayer. Michael is the CEO of Bottomless and owner of a popular pseudonymous Twitter account. We talk about Twitter and media, habits and cultivating a sense of disgust, failure, technology and startups, distinguishing what's important from the noise, and more. Please enjoy. You took a year off of Twitter and came back about a month ago now, or 2 months ago. And as somebody with like a 60,000 person following, and you were kind of well known, at least in my corner of Twitter, for having these incredibly concise bits of wisdom. It was interesting to see you just disappear and then kind of spontaneously reappear. We talked about this a bit in our intro, but was just curious why it is you felt like you needed to take a break, and then what it was that brought you back more recently.
There's a number of reasons that all kind of came together. Thank you for saying nice things about my account, by the way. I appreciate it. I think, you know, the main thing is one day I found that I actually just cared a little bit too much about the reception that I was getting for individual tweets, right? And I found it to have become a sort of unhealthy relationship with the audience, right? Like, as a creator, you want to be putting out things that you think are interesting, primarily to sort of like stay fresh and to have unique insights, and also just to get out of it one of the main reasons that you actually post online is because you actually get something out of it yourself in terms of the creative aspect of refining these ideas to put them out there, right? And obviously the reaction that you get is a big part of why you do it. But if it becomes sort of the driving impulse to get a specific reaction, it can become kind of counterproductive, in the sense that you're actually kind of watering down your own ideas and your own thoughts, or not watering them down, but you're following the audience instead of the audience following you. And I just found like there was one day where I just like I thought that a tweet that I posted was really interesting, and it didn't get a lot of like reaction or traction. and you know, it's kind of embarrassing to say this, but like I lost like a day, not a whole day of like work or anything, but like I was just in a bad mood for like a day. Right. And when I realized that, I just said, I have to stop for now. Right. And so I just stopped. I just deleted the app off my phone and said, I'm going to take a year off. Like, it really was like a spontaneous thing that I decided to take exactly a year off. The interesting thing about it was like, for like maybe a month, I still was just thinking about tweets in the back of my mind. But then that sort of fell off. And so there was some sort of aspect of tweeting and also consuming a lot of tweets that actually was somehow conditioning my mind for the form factor of Twitter. And it's sort of like decayed, I guess. That sort of function in my brain sort of fell off in a natural decay pattern to the point where after like 2 months, I just like wasn't even thinking about tweets anymore. But for the first month, I filled up like a whole 200 tweets I wrote in like notes on my computer just randomly.
The format hijacked your brain in a way, and that resonates with me, because I have that same feeling where I feel this compulsion to try to neatly articulate an idea in a 280 character format, and it becomes this lens that you put on top of kind of all this activity you're doing in the world, which I can feel it's incredibly unhealthy. There's definitely been upsides to this, don't get me wrong. I joke with people that Twitter is simultaneously the best and worst use of my time, because I've met so many interesting people like yourself. But the double-edged sword here is it's definitely hijacked my reward system to a certain extent. And yet I have never taken more than like 2 or 3 days off. And yet I feel this exact thing that you just pointed to. So I want to dig in a little bit more to like, what's kind of the psychological element of why you felt like you had to step away. And this to kind of contextualize this seems like a pattern with you. Maybe I'm creating a through line here where there isn't one, but going back to college, when you dropped out and you felt like you kind of had these average patterns, these normal patterns, and you had to break out of that through the use of habits. There seems to be this unique ability for you where you can change things on a dime. You can change behaviors. Like you recognize it and you want to make that change and you do it. Whereas I think for many people, they just get stuck in the processing of that thing and never actually make the change. Does that resonate, or am I creating a kind of cohesive narrative where there isn't one?
It's a good question. I don't think I'm actually unique in that way, although I do think you're right that maybe other people wouldn't take a year off of Twitter like that and actually do it. I don't know why. I think I do have a refined sense of disgust, which I know is kind of, it may sound strange. But I actually think disgust can be a very...
No, that sounds like a talent.
Well, disgust can be a very useful impulse, right? In particular, self-disgust, right? There's a certain degree of like, if you think you should change something and then you just don't, right? Eventually, maybe the level of self-disgust can reach a point where it's like a tipping point and then you change dramatically, right? And so I wouldn't consider myself somebody that can make a lot of personal change. It's kind of funny to hear you say that. I would actually almost say the opposite about myself. Somebody who maybe has difficulty making personal change. I know people personally that actually will come to some understanding about something and just change on a dime at that point and forever. And I've always found it to be quite impressive and found it to be much more difficult for myself. But perhaps for some of these things that you've keyed off on, it's just a certain level of disgust. So like, for example, yeah, when I was in college and I wasn't doing particularly well in college, at least like the first round, the first time I was doing it as a much younger person, I certainly had a building level of self-disgust about not taking it very seriously. And, you know, what am I doing with my life? Like, if this is what I'm doing with my life, like, I should be taking it more seriously. And then, you know, it probably reached a tipping point where it was just too much. I was just too, I was just too disgusted with the way things were. And then that creates a tipping point. And perhaps people should consider that maybe disgust is a little more useful. And I think for Twitter, for example, it wasn't like, you know, the story I say is, oh yeah, there was one tweet where I cared about what people thought about it. But I think it had been building for a long time. Like, I had noticed for a while that I cared more than I would like to about the reaction that I was getting. And I didn't care enough about my own opinion about whether something was interesting. And that level built up to the point where one day I realized that it had been a whole day that I was upset about something. And then that disgust was such a strong motivator that I was able to just take a whole year off.
Now that you've returned, have you found a new mechanism for or relationship to mechanism for dealing with or relationship to Twitter such that you can get the benefits of it, but you don't have those negative impacts such as kind of pandering to your audience or looking for their validation or thinking through these bite-sized ideas? Have you struck a balance, or are old ways starting to return?
I don't know. I think, you know, coming back after a long time, my mind was not really in the was not really conditioned for Twitter. I wasn't consuming a lot of tweets or thinking about a lot of tweets, and so I naturally was not generating. I haven't been generating too many tweets, right? And so I can't really give you an answer. I do know that I've been posting and not looking at the reaction that I get. But it could be that, you know, I haven't been doing it a lot, so I don't have like a lot of reward expectation from it.
What did you, in your time off, obviously you said in those first couple of months there was this transitionary period, but maybe then you returned to kind of this old state, pre-Twitter old state. What did you spend your time learning or maybe rediscovering over the last year?
That's a good question. It was an interesting thing where I had this hole in my habit structure, the matrix of daily habits, where, you know, like, what do you do when you're standing in line at a coffee shop? You know what I mean? And, you know, you kind of, when you remove something, you're going to naturally fill something else. And so the first thing I tried to do was fill it with books, right? Everybody who considers themselves to be an active mind wants to be a reader, right, of books. You know, everybody thinks that a book, reading books, are somehow like some vaulted activity activity is like better than everything else, right? So yeah, I tried to replace it with a reading habit, and I did to some extent, right? So I'm not sure how interesting it is what I actually did do. I think maybe the interesting thing is like what naturally would happen is I would fill it with things that I would consider actually less productive than reading Twitter. You know, maybe things that I previously cut out, like reading news, for example. Like, I actually cut that entirely out of my life because I don't think that the durability of the information you get from daily news cycles is very good, right? What happened in the first week of June in 2013, right? Who knows? But at that point, you probably were like balls deep in news content, right? And knew all about what's going on. So, I don't know. I had a series of habits that popped up that I then would like chill. Kind of tried to learn to like not actually consume anything, but I don't want to like make the claim that somehow I was some sort of monk or something. I would say my reading consumption went up dramatically. The difficulty though is like a book does not fill the same niche as Twitter.
Right.
Like, it's very hard to just open a book and read for, you know, 2 minutes and then put it back down. It's much more like reading a book is much more like going on a long run, right? Where, you know, it takes at least like 5 or 10 minutes before you're actually in the zone, right? So
yeah, there are particular books that you could slot in that are consumable in bite size, but really reading takes a greater context window.
Yeah, than, sure. You know, some of Nietzsche's aphorism like chapters, like I would kind of pull that up a lot, or I don't know. There's a lot of sort of like aphoristic writing. Probably just filled a lot of the time that I would be doing Twitter with silence, or trying to read, or some worse habits that I am not proud of and was basically playing whack-a-mole with, right? Like, okay, now I'm like reading news, okay, whack-a-mole with that one. Now I'm like doing something else, whack-a-mole with that one. So, these sort of like habitual things are kind of a constant gardening exercise where you have to be pulling weeds, and perhaps Twitter consumption is not actually the worst.
Right. Habits as a vacuum and as a thing that need tending to are interesting metaphors. Did you learn anything new through the adoption of or more time spent in silence in particular?
Yeah, I think the most interesting thing is like when your mind wants to be entertained, it's painful to not be entertained. And you may not ever actually notice that pain if you don't actually force yourself to do it.
Yeah.
It's like actually, it's almost like a physical pain, right? Like if you expect that you're sitting in a line at a coffee shop and you're going to open your phone and look at Twitter, like, and you don't do it and you don't replace it with anything else, like it's actually painful. You know, it's like the brain is constantly doing this prediction of the rewards it's going to get. And like, if it doesn't get a reward, like it actually like creates this reward prediction error, and like the error is like pain, because the neuroscience of it, and so it actually is painful to be in silence and not consume anything. I did find that if you just kind of like eat that pain, it becomes easier. And it's because of this reward prediction framework. Like if you're standing in line at a coffee shop and there's no prediction of a quick hit, like then the craving to do it sort of goes away. But again, I don't want to make it sound like I'm some sort of like monk or perfect person. And for that whole year, I'm just standing in line, not doing anything. But I would say maybe at a higher proportion of time than before.
Yeah, no, that's a fair caveat. You've talked a fair amount here and on previous podcasts and through your Twitter account about this idea of habits and the importance of habits. One of the things that's always struck me as difficult, I think habits have come to carry a negative connotation. There's still positives to it, of course. But there's this side of habits and maybe a chicken and egg problem where it feels like habits should be born out of some higher level or like more core understanding. And it is that awareness that then leads to kind of a more natural evolution of your habits. Whereas I think a lot of people talk about them separated from the understanding. It's like discipline. This lack of understanding drives discipline, drives habits. What's your take on the relationship between kind of understanding and habits, and if there's one that precedes the other?
I think I would reject the premise, you know, that there's a trade-off there's some sort of trade-off between, I don't remember how you put it, like an idea of what you want and then your habits. This sort of like, you know, philosophical sense of what you want or like some goal in life or some understanding, I guess is the word you use. Like, I feel like that's completely orthogonal to habits. Like, for example, like I'm running a company right now. I want to exit the company for $1 billion, right? Like, sure, that's what I want to do. And I have an understanding of how I need to get there, right? And let's say I can break it down into like a week by week plan, right? And, you know, ignoring the fact that rigid plans like that don't work. Let's imagine it would work. It's not at all sufficient, right? To know what you need to do, right? At least for certain kinds of people, right? But if you can't figure out what you need to do, like you're fried anyways, right? Like there's no way you're gonna get to anywhere interesting. So I think you can kind of presuppose that people know what they want to do. Like, I don't know how to put it. I think anybody who's ambitious knows what they want to do, and even if they're completely failing at life, the real challenge for most people is actually getting there. And I think that's why habits are actually really important. And it's just because, you know, the vast majority of what you do is just not something that you consciously execute.
Hmm.
You know, it's like, and I remember picking this up from reading the book, Thinking Fast and Slow. Like the vast majority of your mental processes, people think about habits as like, oh, your morning routine and all these things, but it's a much more profound concept, right? Because it's not just like, I'm going to drink a smoothie in the morning. It's like literally your whole pattern of thought, like your thought patterns themselves are habitual. How you think about a certain concept, you know, car cutting you off while you're crossing the street, like, if you have a certain habit of mind of letting that destroy your day and thinking about how you're going to get back at this imaginary person that, you know, almost ran you over 45 minutes ago. Like that is the contents of your thoughts, you know? And, you know, even like people have a lot of like, intuition pumps, you know, like mental models, et cetera, like, and applying those things are habits of thought. To a certain extent, like the actual things that break out of the bounds of the habits of your mind are like minuscule on a day-to-day basis. You know, it may be an hour out of the 16 hours that you're awake, or actually even less, you know. So I don't know. I think some grand plan or some grand goal or understanding it is good, but it's also meaningless. It's much more tractable, maybe you could say, to focus on your habits of mind and not just your physical habits.
Yeah, I've been thinking about either a subset of or an adjacent idea, which is there's only so much theorizing you can do. There's only so much kind of tossing around the idea in your head. Ultimately, you have to interact with reality in order to get that feedback. And it sounds like, to tie in this concept of habits, I mean, habits are the engine or part of the mechanism to help you approach and respond to or get feedback from reality. And so the theorizing absent the actual action is just kind of leads to this never ending analysis paralysis.
Yeah, I think that's right. But I would even say, like, the theorizing itself has habitual components.
I see.
You know, And to some extent, I'm just kind of like fucking with you here, right? Like, I mean, I'm just kind of like playing with the concept of habits and trying to push it. I'm trying to push it further, to an extent. But you are right. Like, you know, habits can be a way to break out of analysis paralysis, but they can also be a way to get stuck in it, right? Analysis paralysis in and of itself isn't a habit. Like, how you're going to react to certain things.
It's a more meta lens to it, yeah. Understanding that you've talked about this idea of planning elsewhere. I think you had a good tweet about this that was, and I'm going to butcher it, but it was something to the effect of like that quote where people say planning is good until you get punched in the face. But like this idea that your plans don't survive when they meet reality. How far in advance are you planning versus responding to the feedback from those plans? Is it like one step out, or is it a mixture of like, I have this grand vision that's somewhere off in the distance and I know my next step and I'm going to reorient against that every step of the way? Or what's the relationship there?
I can't say that I have the best blueprint for this, but I can say that practically, in my own experience, like running a business, or doing a startup, which is actually, I should actually specify that, because that's different than running a larger business. Like Coca-Cola may be able to plan quite far out. I think for a startup, like, there's not a lot of use in planning that much beyond like your current and next major projects. And the reason is that the current project and the next project can fundamentally change the landscape of your company. You know, like, this project could change, like, I don't know, for an example, like in our company right now, we're working on extending our software to handle not just like the hardware based subscriptions that we do, but also handle like simple, like just the standard e-commerce subscription stuff, right? And we're just doing it because people asked for that, and there's a reason to believe that more people on that, like doing an integrated product, will get more people to sign up for the hardware-based subscription. But like, okay, we can launch that, and we can get people to like migrate all of their subscribers over to our unified platform, and like that could be a complete dead end, right? It could be that, you know, 1% of the people who have a normal subscription in their whole lifetime end up getting a scale instead, for example, or it could be 20% and or 50% or 80%, right? Because on the way out the door of a subscription, you end up actually opting in for this more advanced thing just naturally. And obviously those are extreme, like 1% and 80% are extreme, but like a realistic guess could be anywhere from 5% to 25%, right? And those would fundamentally change what would be the right next thing to do. And so how do you put this? It's like, the next step after we launch that and get that data, like anything that we plan is actually not just irrelevant, it's harmful, right? Because if it's that 25% or 50% of people and we do something other than just focusing on that, like, we are harming ourselves. So so it's actually beneficial to plan very little, I think, in certain environments where what you're doing can fundamentally change. And there's a lot of things like that, right? Like content creation, like you're doing a podcast right now. you know, this podcast is happening to focus on me and I'm not like a mega famous person. You know, maybe I have unique quirks, right? But let's say this episode blows up, right? Which it's definitely going to do. but like, let's say it blows up, like you might change what you're going to do after that. So you shouldn't have like 30 guests planned out.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Maybe somebody like Tim Ferriss should, you know, because then he can actually get better people because he's way out in advance and getting on the calendar like 2 quarters ahead of time or whatever. But I you get the gist of it. I'm going on about this.
What are your criteria and maybe non-consensus or non-obvious criteria about what to focus on next? I think maybe given that the previous experiment was a failure, to your point, obviously, if 80% of people sign up for the hardware, then there's a clear indication that you should double down there. But in the absence of like a clear signal, what are maybe the heuristics or kind of guidelines for figuring out what to focus on next?
Well, I can say that failing is really painful at anything. In particular, like the further along you get, like our company right now, we have, you know, a decent amount of investment. We have customer, like a lot of customers and like employees and everything, like, and doing something that doesn't work is like about 5 times more painful than previously. Although I don't know if that's right, because when I was just me doing it alone and I had just quit my job, well, I wasn't exactly doing it alone. My partner was helping me, but you know, when it was in that really early stage, I think it may have been more painful because there was a lot of risk. But let's just say there's like periods where there's more or less pain and regardless, actually, that may be irrelevant because like it's always going to be more painful to fit. It's like very painful to fail, right? But like a lot of the potential reward is in doing things that are highly uncertain, right? Like if it's certain to succeed, like 1 million people are going to do it. And it's not just in startups, it's like in everything. Content creation, right? Like the more, like the zanier, more off the wall it is, the more likely it is to fail, the more reason nobody has tried it before. So if you have some really good theory as to why it might work, like there's potentially something there, but like you have to be doing, like if you want to get some outsized return, you have to be doing something that's probably going to fail. And that's painful. It's like it hurts to fail. And I know this because we've done a number of things in our company that have failed and they hurt. Right. And the temptation is always to do the safe thing that's not going to hurt, but it's going to hurt you more in the long run to just end up working on something mundane or failing by default. Right. Like just, you know, failing in a way that, you know, everybody can kind of look at you and say you gave the old college try, but eventually you wasted a lot of time and you just failed. Instead of failing at something that looks stupid. Right. And like, I don't know how to put this. Like, the company we're doing, sending people these little devices to like reorder their stuff at home, is a pretty crazy fucking idea. You know, I there's a lot of good reason to do it, but there's also a reason that, like, it hasn't been tried 1 million times by 1 million people, right? And so, you, kind of going into it, you know, like there's a chance that this is just not a good idea. Right, it's probably a good idea, but there's a chance it's not a good idea, and that's kind of like one of the reasons why you should do it. But you have to fail, like you have to be willing to fail, I guess. So that would be like one thing. I don't know how contrarian, like, you know, Yasso and a contrarian idea. I don't know if that's contrarian at all, but it's the psychologically difficult thing that you have to do.
Yeah, I would call it contrarian. Still, I mean, when you think about the percentage of people that are working on projects in well-worn, established kind of sectors or idea spaces, startup, like venture-backed startups, fundamentally, if you've been bet on, there's this idea that you're doing something that hasn't been done before that has this outsized return you were alluding to. So I think that's all wrapped up together.
People dunk on the startup industry so hard for all of these ideas, like, you know, name dropping invest like the best, great podcast, right? recently that had the valuation expert guy. I don't remember what his name was. He's a professor at Duke or something. Great episode. But like, for some reason, the guy just had to drop how obviously stupid these bike sharing startups were. You know what I mean? And he said it in such a smug way. I almost wrote him a strongly worded email. Not really, but like, I imagined writing him a strongly worded email, which is, by the way, a bad mental habit. It's just like, because like, you like, people were going out and trying something that didn't exist, which is like the surface area, it's so exposed, I guess you could say, to the criticism that people are wasting venture capital dollars. And it's like, yeah, sure, in retrospect, that may be the case, but unless you're saying it when they're actually doing these bike startups, it wasn't obvious at the time. Well, although I guess my whole point is that it's obvious at the time that it may be silly, but like, you know, that was obviously great startup. You know, these people that did these bike share things and they put bikes all over the place, that was a great thing. It failed, but it was a great thing to try. You know, it got such like traction and so many people were using it, and like maybe it would be a major mode of transportation, and it's still kind of, the vestiges of it still exist in these scooters, you know?
The trouble is in criticizing the outcome instead of the experiment. It's like we should be advocating for people to do these asymmetric crazy experiments in spaces that Airbnb is kind of like the canonical example.
Oh yeah, like it sounds like a really dumb idea,
right? And and yet has been, I mean, relatively successful.
Massively successful. And like, yeah, I mean, the bike things did expose themselves to be a bad idea. The maintenance is too expensive. They get stolen at too high of a rate. And, you know, there's too much seasonality, and it was a bad idea. And it's good that they did it. You know, like the idea that it was bad that they did it, it's just a fundamentally wrong way to look at these sort of like innovative experiments. And if you're operating one of these things, you should actually have some awareness of the fact that what you are doing is something that's uncertain. And by definition, you're doing something that may be a bad idea. So that is kind of how I think people should think about these things, is you are taking a failure risk every time you're doing something interesting. And it's going to be painful. And there's a reason people say doing a startup is like, you know, chewing glass or whatever. Because like, even if you're doing the right thing, you're still like, it's still going to be painful, most likely.
I think there's also a social versus, or like a societal versus individual lens to this, which is the criticism at an individual level, although I also think still not warranted. Like, I'll maybe give more of a pass, versus the criticism at a societal level is always incomplete, because there's some remnant of this last experiment that's going to, that, you know, 5,000 new startups are going to be born out of, and something as a result of that is going to like change humanity or culture or something. The criticism always feels incomplete in a sense.
They found something that didn't work.
Right. You know? Yeah, we checked something off.
It's valuable in and of itself. And the part of it that did work is valuable. You can leave these assets scattered around the city and people will use it. Right. Like, sure, maybe somebody will figure out a better way to keep the maintenance low and to prevent them from being stolen and give it another shot. And it also did result in these sort of scooter startups, which are a bit of a plague, but also useful.
The experiment success is fractal in a sense, too. It's like there's the macro experimental success. But then to your point, there's all these constituent pieces that you take away and mix and match and build new startups out of.
Yeah, and the value of the failure does accrue to society also.
Exactly.
People talk about how the success value accrues, but the failure value accrues if it's properly sort of covered. And I wish people didn't cover it in such a negative light. You know, hey, this is why it didn't work. It could be like, it's not a personal failure for these people necessarily, unless they execute it poorly.
You've done a fair amount of reading on like at least recent historical business and business figures and inventors. Is there something fundamentally different about our societal and media treatment of them that has led to, maybe it's just my pocket of kind of Twitter and such that makes me think there is a negative view of technology and founders. Maybe this is a cliche at this point, but there seems to be something fundamentally different about how we treat those individuals and support and glorify them. Is that fair, or is that like I said, a cliche at this point? It's not actually true.
You know, I don't know. I have read a fair bit of these biographies of people who created industries and stuff. It's kind of like a favorite genre. I'm kind of like racking my brain. I do think a fair bit of these people were kind of like, how would you put it? Like pilloried in the press of their time. I don't think much has changed, to be honest. I think it's all just rhyming in its own way. And I do think people there is a contingent of people who are quite positive, you know. I think most just like average people are quite positive on technology. I think it might be like Apple is the best brand value in the world. And that doesn't necessarily have to be the case. It could be that Apple is just the best among the technology industry and it's still terrible. But it isn't the case. So I think it's there's some aspect of this that it's just like people who are having their power taken away. You know, you kind of have to just look back at you kind of have to look at a lot of people as like, a lot of the people that rise to the top in every industry are just very ambitious people. You know, the people in the top of politics and media and these other industries are they were the top of their class in their high school and they were very ambitious and they felt like they were destined for success, right? And I think it's deep down it's just a power struggle. You know, technologists obviously have so much power to shape the world, quite a bit more than people in media. And even people in politics and the people in politics get into it because they want power. And I'm just totally like speculating out of my ass on this, but that's just kind of, that's my own personal pet theory. I remember when Trump won, I had this strong sense that they're going to really go after, find a scapegoat in Facebook. Specifically, because there was some sense that Trump's campaign had succeeded quite strongly on social media. So that's some evidence for that theory, to some extent, because there really was a sea change in the way these technology companies were treated, or written about. But it's always been like that, to some extent, I think. And I think, again, it's about power, right? Like these people writing for like TechCrunch that are writing shitty articles about startups. I think it's like these people see themselves, they should be the winners, right? They're the arbiters of what's cool and not cool and what's good and bad, you know? And like they're writing about these companies that are actually clearly having, 100 times the impact than they are.
Everyone's always trying to wield the power in their domain that they have access to kind of counterbalance or succeed over the people who have power in another domain. These things are always kind of in conflict or in checks and balances.
It might be a cynical take, and people should know I have a little bit of a chip on my shoulder. You know, I dropped TechCrunch specifically. I'll say it on your podcast, like fuck TechCrunch. Like,
what's the backstory?
Well, you know, we were going through YC, right? And YC has this thing where they kind of take like 10, they have like an agreement with TechCrunch where, you know, TechCrunch will write about their companies and they will give them access to their companies. But to keep it from being a complete shit show, they will like pick 10 companies to present to TechCrunch and TechCrunch will write about them. There's some, I don't know if that's the exact mechanism, but it was something like that. And our company happened to be picked as like a, good example of a company in the batch, right? Quite a positive experience. And then we got matched to some like TechCrunch journalist, and this lady, you know, met me and like had very little interest in talking to me at all. It was like this really wild experience where she was like, you know, I talked to her for like 15 minutes, went all the way across town to meet at some coffee shop and talk for like 15 minutes, which isn't a big deal. Like, I didn't actually care. I didn't feel like personally slighted or anything, but, you know, maybe a sign that she didn't have a personal interest. But the point is they came out with this article where the headline said, startup has a solution for lazy coffee addicts, right? And if you Google bottomless, you'll still probably find that that's the top article or one of the top articles. But it's like bottomless has a solution for lazy coffee addicts. And it's just like, wow, you know, you're a tech reporter, and that's what you're going to say about what we're trying to build. Lazy addicts. Like, it's like you couldn't try harder to make a more negative spin. And it's like, I don't know. It opened my eyes to the fact that these people are kind of just like, they don't write about technology because they like technology. You know, they write about technology because they want to have some, I don't know why they, why do you think they write about technology? Why do you think these people do? And it's not just us. It's like a lot of things.
Yeah. I haven't thought enough about this. So this is from the hip, but I think some of them genuinely do have an interest in technology. But as to why individual or a subset of that, a cohort of that might write things negatively, I think it is to your earlier point, a bit of like a power play or a flex to be able to shift public opinion on a particular thing. I also sometimes wonder if, you would think people who deal in words understand the power of words. But I sometimes wonder if they don't actually realize the word choice and the impact it could have. Like, swapping the word lazy and addict with two different words is like, could be 180 turn in terms of perception of your company. I don't know, but I also hesitate to just group, you know, all of these people together and say they're all doing these things a similar
yeah,
way.
I'm kind of having fun with it by like, you know, being overly aggressive.
Of course,
you know, it could be something much more benign, which is like, you know, in order to survive as a media company, you have to create something more sensational that's going to get a click. You know, and like this company has a solution to subscription tech that is probably only interesting to like, sort of like gadget nerds, at least back then, you know, post pandemic, I think our tool has a wider appeal, but back then, you know, you kind of have to find a appeal for a wider audience. So, giving them the benefit of the doubt, it's just trying
there's probably something at the intersection of, what's that quote? Never attribute to malice what you could attribute to ignorance. That and like incentives might be the simplistic answer here.
This is actually really funny because my father was a journalist, career journalist, and so I'm kind of like dunking on a whole profession that I grew up kind of respecting. And he very authentically was just trying to provide people with the information. You know, like he covered politics, and he wouldn't even discuss politics because of his own sense of moral obligation to try to be not biased. And and he would say, yeah, very similar to what your quote was. That's kind of why I remember this. He would say, like, never attribute to malice what could be attributable to like incompetence. Which I don't know if that's the case with these people. It's like hyper competitive, so it's probably not incompetence. But
fair.
Yeah, we can give them a break. I'm just like probably a little bit bitter, which is not a good habit of mine either. Speaking of habits,
yeah, you have this. You've had this meta awareness about your habit of mind.
I did get to say fuck TechCrunch though, so it's fine.
That'll be the intro, the lead of this episode.
No, I want them to write about us again still.
Well, now they're going to, now the only, yeah, unless in my case, if they write bad about my podcast and this is the only thing anybody's ever written about it,
it would be a good thing.
Zooming out on startups for a second. Like you alluded to, you went through YC, you've now been active in tech for several years. You have a good kind of grasp on the space in a macro sense. As we have lowered access to information and barriers to entry, I think we're especially seeing this over the course of the last year with the way AI is dramatically lowering the barrier. What do you feel like has been, from the perspective of someone trying to start a startup, what has been commoditized and what is an edge?
I don't know. I don't know about that one, to be honest. I don't know if I actually even have anything to say about that. I think people over-intellectualize it to some degree. Perhaps I think, you know, just making a better product than exists for like a market that really wants it is probably sufficient. And that is actually really hard in and of itself, right? Like, it's hard to figure out what the market really wants. Like, people can tell you something, but like, what are they actually going to buy? And to actually figure out what they're going to buy, you kind of have to make the thing. And to make the thing, if it's something that doesn't already exist, it's kind of hard and takes a lot of work. So, you know, it's much harder than that sort of like simple statement in practice. But I don't think any like product, any aspect of like the potential product and service space is like a dead end necessarily, to be honest, because of some sort of like industry dynamics. Like, I suspect there's always a better way to do things. I'm kind of like a person that thinks there's kind of like an infinite improvement frontier, I guess, in everything. It's like you do the thought of experiment of like thinking of something that you think would be the most mature technology. And you could probably imagine somebody coming in and doing it better, you know, counting software. That's like the original thing people were doing with computers. And like, I would not bet my life on there not being a new accounting software startup, that gets significant margin, market share starting in the last 5 years, that's going to have significant market share in the next, you know, 10, 20 years. Like, I would not bet my life on that.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's the question you asked.
No, that's totally fine. I think the way I think about it, or have thought about it, is the barrier to entry has maybe been lowered. The barrier to starting has been lowered, but the same skills that required actual success, like making it through that 1% filtration event and having a successful business, are the same. They're more or less timeless, which is, to your point, build things that people actually want, which is incredibly simple and difficult at the same time. So maybe the kind of the mouth of the funnel has opened up a ton, but it doesn't mean, you know, substantially more people are making it to the bottom.
Well, maybe something interesting to say about this, because you brought up AI, and this is like, you know, I'm not sure that you can say that AI is lowering the barrier to entry. Perhaps it is, but I also see, when I think about a lot of AI startup ideas, they seem to be features of existing networks and products more than anything else. Like, accounting software is a good example. For example, you may use AI to better categorize expenses. Or I don't know, you can imagine like a million things, or ask questions about your balance sheet or make better projections on your balance sheet. Or like, we could sit here and riff and come up with like 20 things that people are going to do with AI tools. And like, all of those should just be like integrated into existing accounting mm-hmm. systems. Like, it's going to be quite a bit harder to like build a accounting system that's feature parity with what exists, plus AI and win, versus like the existing players just like integrating it, the OpenAI API, with like the proper prompt architecture. So I wonder myself whether this is going to be a great wedge for a lot of companies. It really just depends on how nimble the existing companies are. But like, I guess it's so sexy right now that it's hard to imagine that this isn't something that most companies are thinking about. and at least dedicating some resources to. It's the script on that is yet to be written, because it's hard to say how much of this is going to be dependent on the technical skill and implementation or some secret sauce that people can figure out, whether it's in like prompt, the correct, figuring out the correct prompt through trial and error. Maybe that's just like a recipe, like a secret recipe that is impossible to figure out. It may be that that's hard to find, in which case there's a huge opportunity, and the barriers to entry have never been lower. But if it's not hard to find, if it's literally just implementing the OpenAI API and saying, here's all this data, do this, then I have a hard time imagining, for example, an accounting software, somebody's going to use the OpenAI API to get a wedge into that. And you can apply that to like basically everything.
Yeah, I've written a little bit about this and had the exact same take, that it seems like much of what's being built today is simply table stakes features for incumbents. And in fact, they're way better positioned to build those things than given the existing customer base and product set.
So I guess then the question is like, sorry to interrupt, then the question is like, you know, what is not a platform or a tool that doesn't exist at all? Because you wouldn't even imagine to do it unless you had this sort of large language model ability to take a text input and output another text output. Like there must be a large problem space that nobody even approached or didn't work at all, right? And that's like the only, that's like where people should focus, right?
I think I'm in agreement. There may be exceptions to that in terms of like having access to proprietary data sets that enable you to have better outputs than kind of these open generic data sets. There might be something to be said about like speed of like excellent and speed of marketing being the initial kind of jumpstart you need to then establish your hold. But I, on the whole, I definitely agree with you. On this topic, related to this, you've been working on Bottomless for several years now. I think most people, when they start a startup, the idea is that you're supposed to be able to focus on it for something on the order of like 7 to 10 years. That's the minimum amount of time you're committing your life to this project. But every probably 6 months or a year, there's new shiny objects flying around.
Yeah.
If you were starting again today, or maybe Michael's in alternative universes, what are the one or two or three problems that you'd be really interested in working on?
Yeah, you know, it's a really interesting thing, because if you're the type of person that starts a company, you're probably the type of person who has a lot of different things that they want to do. Right, kind of used to thinking outside the box, and it certainly is one of the difficult things about starting a company, right? It's like the more you succeed at it, the longer you do it, you know? And I would say that like, at least our company has been kind of a different company in every 1 to 2 year chunk, you know? Trying to start it totally bootstrapped with nothing was like just building everything from scratch. And then trying to get like the first like 100 to 1,000 customers is like a different ballgame. It's both like trying to market and also like actually scaling like this like duct tape together thing to actually work for real people and patch all the edge cases, and then trying to get from like 1,000 to 10,000, you're actually having to build out a team for that, which is a different story. And then for us, we sort of pivoted our focus from like B2C to more B2B style go to market, and now it's been like a whole nother company. So you know, either you succeed and you get a whole different thing to work on, you fail and end up working on something else too, or like ideally if it's like the same over like a 3 or 4 year period, like you'll just shut it down. So when you see a company from the outside and people are working on it for a long time, it's actually different companies, you know, at every step. But anyway, what would I be doing in parallel universes? It's like the list is infinite, you know. I have different things I want to work on every week. I think Yeah, there's a real path dependence in life.
There's no one or two. There's no one or two things that have continually stayed front of mind for you. You've been thinking about for years.
There's several I've been thinking about for years. Let me see. What is like the most interesting? You know, the two that come to mind right now are ones that I've actually already discussed before. So it sounds quite. I feel like it gives the wrong impression. That there's always like one or two other ones that you would want to work on, when in reality, it's like a new one every week. The one that pulls right now is just, you know, you have this huge explosion and revolution in LLMs. And like, really, I think people should call them LLMs and not AIs. Let me just say that. It's like, it's fucking annoying. People are talking about AI, but it's actually LLM. Okay? Like, that's what we have. We don't have anything else right now. The LLMs to some extent have some artificial intelligence, but like, you should be specific about what we have, which is a thing that takes text input and gives you text output and has some reasoning, right? And if you're more specific about what it actually does, you can usually come up with better ideas, right? If you're thinking about AIs generically, what kind of ideas might you come up with, right? You may come up with all kinds of the type of like scaremongering stuff that you see people posting on Twitter, that AIs are going to take over the world, you know? And those are really divorced from the reality of what these things actually do right now and may do in the next, you know, 2 to 5 years. And who knows, there might be some runaway thing where they become superhuman AI, but like right now they're LLMs that take a text input and are pretty good at a text output. But anyway, in terms of like an idea based off that is like, you know, I'm always corresponding with people over email. Like, and the surface area of potential people I might correspond with is like huge. It's like a few thousand people that I've probably had at least a few emails with. And part of that is that I like to be involved in customer support. But part of it is we also have a lot of stakeholders, you know, like 50 investors, you know, 50, roaster, like seller partners or more, you know, it's like a couple hundred customers that I've been interacting with intimately. So there's literally probably 1,000 email addresses. And like, I would like an LLM that just summarizes everything about a contact for me, right? That's something that exists with current technology. So easy. I could build that in a week or less, like a good one in a week that's fully functioned. That every time, like, I open up an email, like it says, for a customer, for example, this customer first got their first order on this day and has had 3 orders. And when they correspond with you, they bring up their pet dog. And then I can be like, oh, how's your pet dog doing? Right. You know, could even pull in generic information about this person from the public web too. Like, for example, sometimes we have VIPs that sign up and I would like to know that they're VIPs. I've been surprised sometimes, like, oh, this person I'm corresponding with is a VP at Amazon. Like, it would have been good to know that. So that's like an obvious idea that, like, if I wasn't doing Bottomless right now, I would just hack that together in a week and release it for Gmail. Somebody can do that. You can do that for free. You don't have to give me credit. maybe like an interesting aspect of this is what we were talking about before with like the innovation is going to accrue. A lot of this innovation is going to accrue to like existing customers. So like, you know, Salesforce is like guaranteed to integrate that into their CRM.
Yeah, I was going to say, or HubSpot or.
Yeah, they're all going to integrate this exact same thing into their CRM. It's going to probably exist in Gmail as like a paid plugin or whatever. And like all of the different customer support tools are going to integrate that. And like coming up with this idea, like this idea that I just gave you is probably worth nothing unless you want to make a consumer email tool and compete with Gmail or make like a CRM, you know, maybe it could be a wedge that'll last for like 6 months, but it's not hard to implement this, right? I don't know. A couple other ideas I've talked about a lot is like, I really want to have a space repetition social network. I'm obsessed with
that
idea.
Where you can like bookmark somebody else's work and then it shows up again and again in your feed.
Well, there's a couple of core problems with Twitter. You know, one of it is like, I find it really fucking annoying how it's just always sensational and emotional and like, you know, just a one-off hit for like this hour, you know, and it's fine. It's entertaining, but I wish it was a little bit more aphoristic and information that is like genuinely useful, the type of information I would want to bookmark. But the fitness function on Twitter does not incentivize that, right? The fitness function is for like fun, quick hit stuff, which is cool. It's entertaining. But I feel like if the retweet button was actually a button to space repeat this content for myself, right? I see it, a thing I like, I want to see that in space repetition for the rest of my life. I click that. That is an amazing signal. And that could be the retweet, right? So I see Spencer space the content for himself. Now I'm like, wow, I would like to see the things that you spaced for yourself, right? And the 100 people I follow on Twitter, I would like to see what they space for themselves as well. And so it would actually improve the content quality, not just make a better experience for myself, but make the content better, like evergreen. You would make it an evergreen content. That would be a good name for the app, Evergreen. Right? If anybody's listening, make Evergreen. You don't need to give me credit either. Just make it and let me know.
Three years down the road, though, all you have is spaced content. You no longer have original content because you've liked so many things.
Well, yeah, that's great. I wish.
Then you've curated the highest signal stuff, and it's very timeless.
I wish my feed was like 90% timeless stuff that I've half forgotten from the past. Like, this happens to me all the time, that people actually will like have an old tweet of mine like bookmarked and they like it out of nowhere. Like, this happened to me today. They bookmarked, somebody liked some tweet from like 2019, and I was like, oh, that's interesting. And I had forgotten that I had posted that. I had forgotten that I even thought
that was probably me in preparation for this episode, by the way.
Maybe. But it's a thing that happens, and I'm always like very happy to see it, not just because I get reminded of how awesome I am, which is like of course a nice feeling, but like also it's just like, hey, that's cool, like that's interesting, and I would like to have that for other items that I've seen too. And it would be great if my feed became 90% that, and then you know, people were actually posting less because they're trying to post more evergreen content, but the content's better.
Interesting. There might also be, if you analyze like 1,000 who we deem highly competent people and evaluated the things they had spaced 5 years out, you might notice that there's probably like 10 different core themes across all the things. Like you probably start to move towards these very consistent big buckets of core truths that you want to internalize, which actually maybe dovetails nicely into your kind of philosophy or approach towards content consumption in general, which is this emphasis on, as we were just talking about, highly timeless things. You try to steer clear of the news. How do you, and it strikes me that this is maybe a similar skill set for somebody who tries to start a company, which is you need to be detached from the social reward systems and like memetics that drive people to be kind of average or normal. Like you have to resist the desire for social validation when you aren't somebody who stays up to date on the current thing. Also, when you're doing potentially a highly illegible thing and starting a startup that looks like it might be crazy and fail, it's maybe a more generalizable comment on this. But the more specific question is, how do you resist that kind of social desire for being able to talk to people day to day about the things that are happening? Or is it as simple as like, I don't want to talk to those people who are only focused on those things, and so it's okay?
I think it's certainly true that I personally don't post very much about whatever current thing is, going on, or whatever the current thing is, I guess you'd say. And you know, the question may be why, and I think, again, it comes back to something I said earlier, which is like a refined sense of disgust. I just think it's such a waste of time and energy, the way people are constantly, I don't know how to put it, but like, first of all, whatever the current thing is right now, like you are way more likely to be a pawn in whatever this game that's going on is than actually a live player in it. You know, you're like 99.99% likely to have literally no impact whatsoever. Like, sure, you're tweeting, maybe you tweet something that gets a lot of traction. Like, did you change anyone's mind? Like, maybe you did, right? Maybe you changed one person's mind. Is that worth like consuming your entire world, your entire like universe of thoughts about whatever current thing is right now? And like, okay, there's nothing wrong with consuming your entire universe of thought about a thing, whatever it may be. It could be, you know, Russian miniature dolls, to just think of some random concept in my mind. Like, you get obsessed with this thing and you make your own or whatever, and you take a craft course to make them. Like, that's obviously also like irrelevant for maybe like most, like compared to most of the world. And there's just like attractiveness about whatever current thing is right now, the current thing, that it's like actually relevant and important. And so that's why people like so gravitate towards it. But like, ultimately these things pass and nobody cares. And it had no impact on yourself. And you end up having dedicated a huge amount of your mind and thought to something that, A, you didn't pick. That's kind of why I brought up the Russian doll scenario. Like, maybe if you got obsessed with that, like, it's because it has some sort of interest or relevance for you, right? You didn't pick this. Somebody else picked this, or society as a whole picked it, right? But it's not for you to live a happier and more fulfilling life, or to develop the wisdom that you want, or you know, really pursuing any goal that you want. Like, you just were sucked into this thing purely out of your, you know, not out of your own agency, and you thought about it nonstop for 6 months, and then nobody cared, you know. So I just, you know, I'm giving like a really extreme version of it, but that's how, like, if you really have a proper level of disgust about this sort of waste of energy in the world, and it is a waste of energy, right? Like, for most of these things, and I can't say it about any given thing, because then people are very emotionally wrapped right up in any given thing. But, you know,
you have to say it about the last thing,
yeah, exactly. Times ago. Like, most of them are so, like, imagine if everybody was actually took that energy and focus and I don't want to say something trite, like focused on their own community or whatever, but like just pick something that they actually cared about and focused on it, you know, themselves, the world would be a much better place. And this is actually, you know, to a certain extent, it's mimetic, and there's like an overproduction of thought on whatever that current thing is. Right. And maybe sometimes that's the right thing. Like, if you imagine you are an American in World War II or whatever, right? Like, maybe thinking about current thing was actually important and trying to, but like, what would be the right thing? You know, contributing to like going and getting a manufacturing job. Like, that's the right thing. Not like making posts about how bad, you know, the Japanese are. Right. So I don't know.
The World War II example was actually going to be my counter example. With the follow-up question being something to the effect of, there is a minimum amount of awareness you have to have for what's going on in the world. Because say you're in 1937 Germany and you've just completely shut yourself out to the news.
I think we have to stop. I think we have to stop the podcast now. You know, now that we got to Hitler, we have to stop the podcast.
Oh, this is a topic that can't be broached.
No, not that it can't be broached. It just means we've reached the end of, you know.
Oh, I see.
The extreme of potential discourse. But no, sorry, go ahead.
I think you get where I'm going, which is just that there's a point at which the current thing becomes a semi-permanent thing.
In very few cases.
But then also, that's one example that's a little bit more extreme. A maybe more tangible or relevant example would be for you. Today is 11. We're recording this on the 6th. OpenAI just had demo day today. I don't know if you watched it. I imagine you'll read something about it. But there's some amount of that is a current thing. The pace of innovation moves very rapidly. You work in technology. You need to have some awareness of that no. So like, where do you, and maybe you would distinguish between things in a professional or business sense, which actually do have a bearing on your day-to-day versus like kind of empty news. But where, what is that balance to be struck?
Okay, so we can talk about current things in technology, right? So crypto was a current thing in technology for a few years, and that had a net negative impact on the world, right? If you think technological progress is actually important, then like distracting the entire tech industry about your get rich quick schemes, like actually robbed from our great grand, like well-being from our great grandchildren, right? like we should be actually like excommunicating the crypto promoters from the tech industry rather than people that don't make the right political posts about, Me Too or no specific examples, right? We should be excommunicating the people that turned into like crypto coin promoters for a few years, for robbing well-being for my great grandchildren. But what you have to do, I think, is figure out what is the base truth about what's going on, right? So like crypto, there was some interesting base truth. You know, you have this mechanism of creating decentralized ledgers. That's a new thing. And that's interesting in and of itself. And so you have to focus on what is like, is this a new primitive, a new technological primitive? If it is, it's good to know about because you could build something, or it's good to be aware, like new technological primitives can change the world, right? Now, okay, so like NFT collectibles, they in and of themselves are pretty much bullshit, right? But people conflate this thing that's a new primitive that is potentially world changing with like what people actually come up with to do. Right. Like those are two separate things. You know, like just because you're hyped on a new technology.
Identify what's actually valuable fundamental here.
Yeah, like what is the actual thing that you can do now that's new? And like focus on that. That's cool. That's interesting. That doesn't mean everything that uses that is cool and interesting. And I think that's important with this AI stuff. And that's why I kind of said, okay, let's not call it, don't call it AI. It's not sure, it's intelligent. Like it is to some extent AI, but it's really an LLM. So like, you know, I try to read a lot about like the capabilities of LLMs, how they work, et cetera, and, you know, play around a lot with ChatGPT and like to really understand what is this thing? What can you give it? What does it output? Like, what is this new primitive and how does it work? Right. But that does not mean that everything that uses an LLM is like earth shattering and is going to change the world, right? LLMs will change the world.
Right.
That doesn't mean we have to get hyped up on everything. Like, look at what it actually does, right? Helping me buy a rock for $10,000. And I know like I'm doing the thing that I was criticizing about the people criticizing like...
That's your TechCrunch headline?
Yeah, this is my TechCrunch headline. So I should stop myself. But like, you have to look at like what it is that people are actually doing. And decide for yourself whether that's actually interesting.
On this topic of kind of trying to derive what the valuable insight is, or the fundamental thing, novel thing, or new primitive is, you had this tweet that I really enjoyed that was almost every building block for your thoughts is a viral idea, and I feel like ultimately that's what you're trying to do with your pseudonymous Twitter account, is like find those building blocks. What are maybe some of the kind of meta building blocks, or like those things you consistently, those ideas you consistently return to that form kind of the foundation of your worldview and how you operate?
Well, first of all, that concept itself is somewhat interesting, in terms of thinking about, I guess you could call it the provenance of an idea or of information itself, right? So like, I guess that comes originally from, you know, like Taleb's concept of things being Lindy. But I think that kind of just scratches the surface. It kind of like brings up the concept of what is the fitness function of information. And so you can kind of consider that in a lot of different spaces, right? Like, okay, what is the fitness function of information on Twitter? It's that it's somewhat sensational and entertaining, and it's going to make me look cool to repost it. you know, but, and, you know, and the Lindy thing is like, okay, if it survives for long enough, then it clearly has a good fitness function. That tweet you're referencing is like everything has that gets to you was a viral idea. And that's just the idea that like, it's just kind of like, you know, do the math, right? Like how many ideas are you encountering, first, party, right? Like,
yeah,
like, very few, through like friends or family for them saying it for this first time. And they're generally picking up information from the zeitgeist vanishingly small amount. Everything else had some sort of like propagation, and so had some sort of fitness function through a certain amount of people. Like even that Taleb idea, like had to sort of like be catchy enough, not just, you know, not just for him to post it, but like for his original ideas to be catchy enough for the guy that published his book, you know? And so there's like, there's some idea that like every idea or thought or building block of thought that you have, is somehow like sexy to somebody, to put it provocatively. And so there's probably a lot of truth in unsexy, thoughts. But anyway, your thought is like, your question is like building blocks. Like what are some building blocks? I think that's one of them. I think considering like what is durable, and what is not durable, to the extent in the sense of like your own, like what you want to promote. You know, like there can be a good in your life that is not durable, and investing too much in that is not useful. And that's like, you know, taking full circle to the habit conversation in the beginning, like, you know, a habit that is like 1/100th this good and is like a good thing you could do instead is like the habit's going to be repeated 1,000 times, you know? And so, you know, you have to consider like something that takes some act of will, even if it's 100 times better, is probably worse than like focusing on what am I habitually going to do in this case. Unless you're in an exceptional situation, like you're on trial and testifying or something, or I don't know, on a podcast.
The comment about will, by the way, to go back to my earlier question about understanding versus habits and the relationship between them, is that's kind of what I was talking about, is the will that you have to impose on yourself in order to do these habits versus understanding, and the habits flow from that. We don't have to return to that comment, to that line of conversation, but that those are interconnected.
The thing you're going to will, if it's not going to be habitual, better be really damn good or really damn important. You know, if you think about
absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. The final question that I ask everyone is, what's one question you would leave me and listeners with, whether to think about or act on?
Maybe a meta question, right? If you got to the end of this podcast, you just consumed a lot of content and you're going to forget all of this. You know, if you're listening to this, you're going to forget all of this, right? I think a good exercise when you're done listening to a long piece of content is to actually try to consolidate, like, what about this do I want to actually take with me? You know, one thing I would say is like, you know, I'm giving a lot of advice that seems kind of self-improvement like, and, you know, I'm not perhaps the most successful person. I'm a semi-successful person, you might say, or maybe I'm on the knife's edge between being highly successful or needing to start from scratch, right? Who knows? You don't even know anything about me, you know? You don't know whether I have a happy home life. I do, but you don't know that. And you don't know that whether I'm a miserable schmuck, deep down. you know, think for yourself, what is it that actually resonated with you that you think would be useful for yourself in terms of like what habit of mind, perhaps, you know, like maybe expand this concept of habit beyond just, you know, taking a cold shower in the morning or something, which I recommend, by the way. Expand it beyond that. Like what habit of mind can you change? And maybe that's something you can take away. So, yeah, come up with your own question. I'm not going to do it for you.
Like that. We'll plug your self-improvement course at the end of this.
Oh, God, no.
Awesome. Well, this is great. Michael, thank you so much.
Thank you. I had a lot of fun.
Good. That's the goal here.